later in Macro Sunday.
Story, Japan is fixed type narrative.
I think we just introduced a new Perkins rule. Buy value stocks if AC Milan is on top of the Serie A leaderboard, right?
But the thing is, it actually works. So if you think about, you know, when Milan were actually good, you know, 60s, 90s, early 2000s, and then, you know, horrible in the decade after the global financial crisis, and then sort of brief comeback after COVID, there you go. It's a sort of, and it's the Manchester United. If you don't like Milan, you know, it works for Manchester United as well, because Manchester United's performance and AC Milan's performance over the decade is sort of perfectly correlated as well.
That's a great observation. You're listening to Macro Sunday, hosted by Andreas Steno. Hi, everyone, and happy Sunday. Welcome to the Macro Sunday podcast. I'm Andreas Steno, and as per usual, I'm joined by you, Mikkel Rosenwald. Welcome to you.
Thanks a lot.
We're going to play around with the concept a little bit here today, allowing you to be the co-host more than the guest, in a sense, Mikkel. So what's on the agenda today?
We have a lot of different topics. You've returned from London. Let's start there. How was it over there?
Well, London is always a mixed bag of goodies, if you ask me. I'm happy that I not live there. Sorry to those of you who do. But I prefer smaller cities than London. But the vibe was pretty okay among most of our hedge fund clients. And I think there is kind of a growing optimism around Europe making a comeback, which is a bit of an interesting story here. We've been sort of banging the drum on the same, but some of our nowcasts have actually flipped lately, and I think we need to discuss that today, maybe.
Yeah, we'll get back to that. We'll talk a lot more about reflation. We'll talk a lot about some movements in our portfolio that you may have picked up or we're moving towards after your trip to London. We'll get back to our portfolio in, towards the end of the show, after the interview with Daria Perkins, fan favorite that we have back this week. After the interview, we'll also touch a little bit upon my topic, geopolitics, terror attacks in Moscow and whatnot. Remember that you can gain full access to our research and our analysis, as well as our live portfolio on stenoresearch.com. You can either sign up for a free 14-day trial or a free newsletter where you get a couple of nuggets and some hints at what we're looking at. If you want the real deal, you need to sign up for a subscription. So there's that. So Andreas, you've been banging the drum on a new on a topic that I maybe need a little bit explaining, this this concept, head fake reflation. What on earth does that mean?
Well, I guess a head fake is sort of a fake move in the opposite direction of what actually happens beneath the surface. And we've been talking a lot about reflation out of China, reflation out of Europe, and especially reflation in the US economy since late last year. We've seen how equity markets have thrived in this environment. We've seen how commodity markets have started making moves. And we also see increasing speculation in an actual comeback in China and Germany, to take a few examples. And central banks are currently allowing this theme to feed itself, if you ask me. When we look at what the J-Man said at the latest FOMC meeting,
Jay Powell,
he allowed for an sort of implied easier path ahead for the inflation-adjusted Fed funds rate. They increased the inflation forecast, but they kept the promises of three cuts intact at the same time. So basically, the implied interest rate adjusted for inflation is now even lower than it was in December when they did the latest forecast update. That is, to me, very interesting given the two hot inflation reports we've received from the US economy. So what's my point here? My point is that it seems like central banks will actually allow higher inflation prints.
And still cut.
and potentially still cut, right? That is to me a very, very strong sign that markets can party for now. Why am I calling it a head fake then? Well, it sounds like, or it seems like something that we've seen before. We know that the lags between interest rate hikes and the actual repercussions for homeowners, those lags are longer than they've been historically, at least in many of the countries we discuss here. And the US is a great example of that because of a longer duration profile of mortgages on average. While we do actually see the first signs of the true ramifications of interest rate hikes in Sweden, Canada, and some of the monetary canaries. I know Dario very much agrees with this when we discuss with him in a short while. So I think there's a clear risk that what we are currently amidst is sort of an early celebration of rate cuts for kind of the wrong reasons. But for the tradable horizon right now is one of reflation. If you're of a slightly longer sort of time frame in your investment setup, I'm not necessarily sure that this is something that you should celebrate, because this is short-term returns that you likely steal from the future, in a sense.
Yeah. So when will investors begin to fear inflation as the main topic?
Well, you could argue that they've already started to do so to a certain extent. Mm. We track a basket of inflation-sensitive equities in the U.S. Those names are mainly found within energy companies, companies in the materials and industrial space. And that basket has outperformed everything over the past month. And it kind of rhymes with what we're seeing in market-based inflation expectations in the U.S. Inflation expectations are up dramatically since New Year. And it makes sense given what we've seen from the first couple of inflation reports. When we add the current issues in shipping, not least mentioning the collapse of the bridge in Maryland, I think there's a clear risk that the goods inflation will increase during the spring. And it arrives at a very suboptimal timing for the Federal Reserve, basically, because they hope that housing inflation will dissipate fast enough for the cyclical inflation not to catch up. But I'm not sure that housing inflation will be gone by the time where cyclical inflation is back, given everything that we've seen in financial conditions, given everything that we've seen in commodities and so on and so forth. So will the Fed eventually cut? I'm not sure.
That's a big question.
Yeah, I'm not sure. No. I've said that a couple of months in a row now. I know that my Danish friend Thorsten Sluk at Apollo agrees with me, but I think he's the only one on earth agreeing with me. Yeah. I see a much better scope for cuts in Europe, but we'll get back to that.
Yeah, let's move on to that. Actually, I wanted to look beyond the US and look at Europe and Asia as well. Will the European Central Bank cut faster than the Fed?
I think that goes without doubt. Basically, we've seen how the Swiss National Bank moved last week. We've seen how the Riksbank, the Swedish Riksbank, basically gave a 50% probability to a cut in May. Mm. And you could argue that those are two of the central banks that you need to watch to learn what the ECB will do next. The ECB may still surprise in April. We've seen a couple of members of the committee hinting that at least they want to discuss the opportunity of cutting.
Surprised by cutting in April.
Yes. Yeah. It's kind of a done deal that they cut in June now. I mean, everyone expects it. But if they want to create an actual impact, they need to cut in April. Whether it makes a ton of sense to put all your money on that, I don't know. I don't think it does. But the trajectory is clearer than it is for the Federal Reserve. And frankly, I don't see signs in either the IFO survey or in PMIs, for that matter, in Europe, of underlying inflation pressures emerging from shipping, for example. But we do see those signs in the US.
Yeah. What was the impression on Asia you got out of talking to customers in London? I mean, we've been in the South Korea trade for a couple of weeks, maybe getting a little crowded. What's the impression you get out there? We're going to talk a little bit more Japan with Dario.
Well, I mean, in every single meeting we talk Japan with hedge funds. I don't claim to be a Japan expert, and I think I have to admit that, seen from the outside, even though I've been there quite a few times meeting clients, the Japanese inflation discussion is very much one of psychology. If you're one of those subscribing to the notion that psychology can actually drive inflation, then Japan is basically your case study, right? I'm more of the view that money trends drive inflation, that it's a very mechanical process. You need to look at the amount of money in circulation relative to the amount of available services and goods. And I simply don't see that change of scenery in Japan in the underlying money data. We had a swift comeback to the money growth in private terms in Japan between 21 and 22, partially into 23. So the private money pool actually did grow for the first time in quite a while. That's, of course, a game changer. But have a look at the trend over the past 6 months. It's basically reversed. So talking about head fakes, I think this inflation spiral that we've seen in Japan is a head fake, especially also given their ties with China on trade, where you often see Chinese trade patterns spilling over to Asian counterparts with, or price patterns rather, to Asian counterparts with a time lag. And I guess it goes without saying that China has seen deflation lately.
Absolutely. So how to trade all these head fakes? We'll get back to that after the interview with Dario. But right now, I think we should put a little bit of music that Dario requested himself as an introductory. I think it's from the hit series Gomorrah. So let's have that.
Senza che stanze, quando tornano alla scuola, quando stanno a basso bar e mettono mani in pistola, droga e tutta la distoria, a terra nei cami che scoria.
We now have a fan favorite back on the Macro Sunday podcast, Dario Perkins of Tia's Lombard. Great to see you again, Dario.
Good to see you. Good to be back in the Sweeney sauna. Well, being the Sweeney sauna, if not in it. I'm not sure I want to be in it, just for the record.
It's getting hot in here, and I have no further comments than that, Dario.
That's a song, isn't it?
But Dario, I want to talk to you about Japan today. I was in London last week discussing, among other things, the Japanese case with a load of hedge funds. And it seems like it's basically the center of attention for global macro funds right now. And I met with the view that there is a clear risk, if you put it that way, that the Japanese case could turn into a very different case from an interest rate perspective compared to what we've been used to. So this whole story of the Japanization of the world and the Japanization of Japan, for that matter, do you think it's a story that we need to revisit now, given what we see globally?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not 100% sold on the idea that Japan is turning structurally reflationary or structurally inflationary. I think, you know, I've been doing this a long time, and there are certain themes that seem to come around every so often. One of them is, you know, Japan is going to escape the zero bound. Another is the German consumer is back. The other one is China's Minsky moment. You know, usually when these come round, it doesn't end very well, particularly Bank of Japan rate hikes, because the Bank of Japan has had this really nasty habit of sort of marking the peak of the global cycle by raising interest rates, and then the shit has hit the fan and everything's gone wrong. So I have that sort of skepticism, but I think that it's interesting to me that this shows you how much the narrative has changed. Because as you said, you know, the 2010s, was all about the Japanization of the world. There was this sort of presumption from a lot of global investors that Japan was the end game, you know, that demographics was destiny, was the famous sort of catchphrase. And so you saw this sort of progressive, Japanization, particularly in Europe. You know, we spent a lot of the 2010s debating whether Europe was turning into Japan and whether, you know, when you had negative interest rates in Europe, it seemed to be very much going in the same direction. And then fortunately, the IMF came out and marked the end of this by saying the whole world was in a global liquidity trap at the end of 2020. And then you get the biggest surge in global inflation for half a century. So, you know, that narrative has really shifted. And now we're looking at a world where it definitely seems to be structurally inflationary. And so we're looking at a world where even Japanese policymakers are beginning to think that maybe the rest of the world will actually pull them out of this liquidity trap that they've been in. So you just have the complete opposite narrative. You have the de-Japanization of the world, even of Japan, potentially. And, I find that sort of fascinating. Whether this is sort of genuine, I mean, there's always been this debate about why Japan was in the state that it was in. My reading is that basically you had this enormous asset price bubble in the 80s. That bubble burst at the start of the 90s. You had a series of sort of disastrous policy errors. They didn't capitalize the banks quickly enough. They didn't use monetary policy aggressive enough. Nobody really knew what QE was. They didn't have any of the sort of, you know, post GFC response that we had in the rest of the world. You just let this sort of problem fester on balance sheets. And then you got this sort of long balance sheet recession. And then over time, that sort of fed into psychology. So you had this sort of very deflationary psychology. Companies were very reluctant to increase their prices because if they did, it usually sort of met the national news. You know, company X is raising its prices by 5%. What on earth are they doing? Workers didn't expect or demand wage increases because prices weren't moving. So you got into this sort of deflationary trap. And then, you know, over time, other factors like demographics seem to feed into that and sort of reinforce that. And I guess, you know, most of that is beginning to change now. You know, monetary policy and fiscal policy have been much more aggressive than we saw at any point in the 90s or the early 2000s. There's a genuine desire to learn from the mistakes, you know, this sort of premature policy tightening that they had in the past, both fiscally and monetary, which sort of gave you these periodic surges in the yen, which obviously didn't help if you were trying to escape from deflation. So there's a deliberate, you know, objective of avoiding those mistakes again. We're seeing signs that the psychology is beginning to shift. So we had two wage rounds in a row now, two annual wage rounds, where the Japanese worker has demanded and secured, you know, pretty hefty nominal wage increases. We're seeing the distribution of prices beginning to shift. So the sort of the CPI sort of moving higher in all of its components, which suggests that companies feel more willing to raise prices. And then those structural forces seem to be turning. So the Bank of Japan is quite clear that it thinks demographics is no longer as deflationary as it was. And you're looking at a world of sort of deglobalization, you know, very different from the globalized world that we had before. And particularly, you know, Japan's exposure to China in the 90s onwards, that sort of China shock 1.0, you know, Japan was particularly exposed to that. So if we're in a world now where you've got sort of deglobalization and a different demographic pattern, then, you know, it's conceivable that Japan finally starts to escape. As I said, I'm not completely bought into that story, but I think there are certainly elements of truth in it. And I certainly see a more structurally inflationary global economy.
Mm. So there you, if we look at the question of demographics, I absolutely agree with you that through the 2010s, the global discussion almost resembled the Japanese discussion on demographics with a 10-20 year time lag. But if we look at the Japanese demographics, they obviously have a very old population. But how do you view demographics from a structural perspective from here? Do you actually agree with Bank of Japan that we are at a turning point for the Japanese demographic cycle?
Yeah, I think we're at a turning point globally. So, you know, the view about how demographics would play out, sort of consensus mainstream view, was always much too simplistic. It was just this idea that, you know, the population would be growing more slowly. So that meant you needed less investment. That meant that the equilibrium interest rate declined, and that made it was harder for central banks to sort of get reflation. What we're seeing playing out here is that this isn't just about investment. Yeah, you know, investment is lower with an older population, but it's also about savings. And when you hit a certain point and you get these sort of really older workers dropping out of the labor force and they stop working, then the savings rate plunge as well. And so, you know, for the last 20 years, we're in this sort of world where you had this sort of bulge of middle-aged people. And, you know, they're expecting this long time in retirement because life expectancy was increasing as well. So you had, you know, a big sort of bracket of middle-aged people, big increases in life expectancy. And so you had this sort of rampant savings behavior. And, you know, that was causing equilibrium interest rates to decline everywhere. Now we're reaching the point where these older workers are dropping out of the labor force. So you're beginning to get labor shortages. You're beginning to get, you know, declines in savings behavior. And that is actually beginning to push equilibrium interest rates higher. So, you know, the data that the Bank of Japan, you know, talked about sort of in December, looked at sort of participation rates in the over 75s and shows this big plunge in participation rates at that point. And their argument is that, you know, all of the sort of baby boomers, this sort of generation that have dominated the global economy over the past sort of 40, 50 years, they've now basically reached 75. So they're all dropping out of the labor force. And this all sounds, you know, sort of very theoretical. But we have a case study in this now because we saw this during the pandemic. Mm. You know, during the pandemic, when we had older people were afraid of getting COVID, because they were much more exposed to it and much more likely to die if they caught it, you saw this big acceleration in early retirements in places like the US, and it created these labor shortages. And then you saw these big increases in wages among, you know, younger workers who sort of took advantage of that. And so, you know, we have the sort of theory of it, but we have the case study now as well. And, you know, it doesn't surprise me that we're now hearing that this is also happening in Japan.
We've also seen how Japanese asset prices have moved quite a lot over the past year or two. We even see a very positive cycle in the Nikkei index now, and we're back at all-time highs after decades of weak trading. Wealth effects and the impact of wealth effects on inflation. When we see the average household or the average investor in Japan gaining domestic returns again, do you think that matters for the inflation psychology in Japan?
I think it's helpful. I mean, I've never been sort of convinced by wealth effects from stock markets. You tend to get bigger wealth effects from housing, for example. Mm. So the sort of, you know, spillover from rising stock markets to consumption seems to be quite weak across, you know, all sorts of economies. But I definitely think, you know, we've certainly seen the end of the deleveraging cycle in Japan. So if you look at BIS data on private credit to GDP, it's basically been rising since about 2015, 2016. So that balance sheet recession is definitely over. I think that there is a bullish case for Japanese equities, irrespective of whether you buy into this sort of secular reflation story for Japan. Which is that, you know, for a long time, the stock market in Japan just wasn't really working. You know, the corporate governance was horrendous. You had these sort of powerful cross holdings of companies that were basically companies taking sort of strategic interests in their competitors and their suppliers in order to sort of, cushion them from competitive pressures. So the stock market wasn't really working in the interests of shareholders. And, you know, that's beginning to change. You know, the sort of the big sort of signal was last year when the sort of CEO of the Tokyo Stock Exchange sort of calling out companies for, you know, having weak balance sheets, for not acting in the interests of their shareholders. You're beginning to see a lot of buybacks. So these companies are selling these sort of strategic holdings that they had and buying back their own shares. So it seems that this whole sort of corporate governance story is shifting, and there's an awful lot of value. So, you know, I'm an AC Milan fan, so I've always been a bit of a value investor, you know, suffered a decade of disaster. And I was expecting that sort of value would have a comeback after the pandemic. And for a brief period, it did, you know, a bit like AC Milan winning the Scudetto in, just after COVID. And then it sort of died again. But Japan is the one area where this sort of value investing is working, because there are a whole bunch of companies that have been completely beaten down that weren't acting in, you know, shareholders' interests over the past sort of 20, 30 years. And so although you look at the stock market and you say, well, it's at, you know, the highest level since 1989, since this whole bubble burst, if you look at sort of PE ratios, I mean, they're still incredibly low. So there's a lot of value there. So, you know, just the fact that you're getting these shifts in corporate governance and you've got, you know, mildly improving domestic growth story in Japan, that in itself, I think, is enough to sort of push Japanese equities further without having to buy into this whole, you know, structural reflation story, Japan is fixed type narrative.
I think we just introduced a new Perkins rule: buy value stocks if AC Milan is on top of the Serie A leaderboard, right?
But the thing is, it actually works. So if you think about, you know, when Milan were actually good, you know, 60s, 90s, early 2000s, and then, you know, horrible in the decade after the global financial crisis, and then sort of brief comeback after COVID. There you go. It's and it's the Manchester United. If you don't like Milan, you know, it works for Manchester United as well, because Manchester United's performance and AC Milan's performance over the decade is sort of perfectly correlated as well.
That's a great observation. There you go. Reading Japan into the context of global central banks is a bit tricky here, if you ask me. Obviously, they moved the needle, say 10 to 20 basis points, 20 basis points at the max at the latest BOJ meeting. But what if the rest of the G10 central bank community starts cutting interest rates from June and onwards? Do you think the Bank of Japan will just lean back and allow them to sort of tighten the spreads relative to Japan, or will they actually move on and hike interest rates even further in such a scenario?
I think that the Japanese want to be really careful this time. Mm. You know, we've had this sort of series of false starts. You know, we joked about this at the start, this idea that, you know, they sort of mark the top of the cycle. You know, when they've raised interest rates in the past, even sort of tentatively, you've had these big appreciations in the yen, and then that's just destroyed the reflation story. And everything sort of screams that they can't let this happen again. You know, all of these sort of carry trades begin to unwind again, and you get these big moves in the currency. So they're desperate to prevent that from happening again. So they're going to have to tread, you know, very carefully. I think, you know, they wanted to end negative interest rates, because negative interest rates was just an extremely silly policy. You know, we tried this in various countries, and if anything, it was sort of a net negative for the economy and the banking system. You know, it did nothing to stimulate the economy, as far as I can see. They wanted to end QE, because QE is another ridiculously silly policy that does nothing for the real economy. And they were getting to the point where there were no more bonds for the Bank of Japan to buy anyway. So, you know, these were sort of technical adjustments in policy. The idea that they're going to, you know, raise interest rates aggressively in a world where all of the other central banks are cutting, given the risks to the currency, I just don't see that at all. I think they're going to be, you know, much more careful than that to prevent it. But as far as the other central banks, you know, are concerned, they now finally seem to be sort of willing to take the win on inflation. I know you don't quite buy into the idea that inflation is sort of, you know, that we're not going to get this second wave of inflation. But I think that for those rest of the world, They can see that holding interest rates at their current levels is going to cause, you know, certain risks, particularly to areas like commercial property and corporate funding over the next 2 years. Mm. And so if they can cut rates soon, they can head off a lot of potential problems. So, you know, those central banks will be cutting. I think that limits, you know, how much the Bank of Japan will be willing to hike. But I think they'll be limited anyway, given the history of policy errors and fiascos. Mm.
We've seen cutting action from both the Swiss National Bank, but also a couple of Eastern European central banks over the past weeks here. We saw how the Swedish Riksbank earlier said that they intend on cutting interest rates in either May or June. But what about the two elephants in the room in Europe, Bank of England and the European Central Bank, Dario? I know you follow both of them very closely. Do we have a cutting cycle right around the corner?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for the Riksbank and the Bank of Canada, I mean, you know, they have taken interest rates to levels that were dangerous for their economies. Mm. They should have already cut interest rates and cut interest rates quite forcefully, I would have thought. Because, you know, it goes back to a discussion we had once before about monetary canaries. You know, there were certain countries that were much more sensitive to interest rates going up. Because of the nature of the debts that were on the balance sheet. So you had a lot of debt, but you had a lot of variable rate mortgages and variable rate corporate loans. And if something was going to break, it was always going to break in the likes of Sweden and Canada first. And I think, you know, those economies are closer to that breaking point still. You know, we're not really seeing sort of definitely genuine recessionary dynamics, but we're sort of flirting with that in those countries. So those central banks need to cut. The ECB has probably raised interest rates too far. It chased the Fed up. It got engaged in this silly reverse currency war that we talked about last year. They sort of got away with it. They got away with it because nothing ever happens in Europe, basically. Because, you know, I used to follow the euro area economy, and it was incredibly boring because, you know, it's just sort of years of nothingness. And the reason for that is that, you know, companies just don't make big decisions. You know, if they fire workers and hire them back again, it's going to cost them sort of 2 years of severance pay. So they hang on to their workers. And so the labor market just sort of stagnates, but you don't get big job losses. And so you don't get that sort of, you know, genuine recessionary dynamic kicking in. And that allows the ECB to mess about and waste time, which is basically what they've been doing, you know, throughout this year. So they got away with it, but they do now seem to be willing to actually, you know, look at the economy and see, you know, see that inflation has come down and is coming down quite quickly, see that the economy isn't growing and that they've got all sorts of problems in those economies. And it looks like they're signaling a rate cut. And they're so brave, they're willing to signal this rate cut before the Fed has moved, which was a question mark a few months ago. But, you know, they do also seem to be quite unwilling to diverge too much from the Fed, which is, you know, what has always got them into trouble in the past. This sort of unwillingness to move away from what the Fed is doing. And it's the sort of, you know, the joke of independent monetary policy. I mean, how independent is the ECB if it's just doing what the Fed is doing? But, you know, they do seem willing to engineer that first cut. As far as the Bank of England is concerned, I think the Bank of England's situation is a little bit more difficult. You tend to get sort of weaker hiring and firing costs in the UK. So we're more likely to see the UK labour market, you know, start to break than we are the euro area labour market. We've got a lot of variable rate mortgage, which sort of kicks in after 2-3 years. So the squeeze from monetary policy is going to get bigger. But we also have, we had very severe labor shortages and very rapid wage inflation. And that has made, you know, the Bank of England a little bit reluctant to move because they've been so pessimistic about what that says about the supply side of the economy. But I think even the Bank of England is now, you know, on the verge of pivoting. Some of the crazier members of the MPC have stopped wanting to raise interest rates, which is a good sign. So we seem to be on the verge of that pivot. It's just that, you know, it's happening quite slowly everywhere. And it's happening slowly because central banks basically have the time to, you know, think about this a little bit more. But, you know, I don't think we're completely out of the woods on monetary policy. You know, I think that if you think about how monetary policy is working, some parts of the transmission mechanism are basically working quite normally. So, you know, we've killed credit growth, we've killed housing market activity, we've killed home building, we've killed durable goods demand, all of that stuff you get in any interest rate cycle. What hasn't kicked in is the income effects from interest rates going up, which is where you squeeze the purchasing power of borrowers. And that dynamic just is now beginning to kick in. You know, we had a lot of terming out of loans, so it slowed it down. But it's beginning to kick in. You know, corporate loans in particular are beginning to roll over at higher interest rates, which will squeeze their balance sheets. At some point, if that continues, you start to run into genuine financial distress. You know, that's what causes financial distress. You know, when you push debt servicing ratios beyond certain points. And I think central banks can see that this sort of dynamic is starting, and they now have the option of sort of heading that off. The lesson from all of this is that, you know, they can't raise their inflation targets. And we talked about this, you know, sort of several times over the last 2 years, but they can have a real preference for higher inflation, which means that if inflation settles at 3%, they're not going to engineer a recession for the sake of that extra 100 basis points. And that, I think, is what we're seeing playing out everywhere. You know, central banks are basically saying, well, you know, we've made a lot of progress on inflation. We're not back at 2%, but maybe this is good enough. And it's good enough if we can, you know, have this without causing a recession. And that's basically what we have, a real preference for higher inflation everywhere.
Final quick question, and I expect a quick response. Does it matter whether we have 2 or 3% inflation in an economy?
No. That's quick enough. Yeah, I think, look, there's this sort of fantasy that if you have inflation above 3%, it sort of spirals and turns into something really nasty. And it's all based on the 1970s. And I don't know how many times we've discussed the 1970s over the past 2 years. But, you know, it's completely the wrong framework. You know, you have a completely different economy to what you had in the 1970s. So the idea that you're just going to get this spiraling of inflation is based on one episode in history. There are plenty of examples of all sorts of economies that live with, you know, 2, 3, 3.5, even 4% inflation, and nothing spirals. You know, the central bank doesn't just lose control of inflation. And so, you know, if we're sort of living with this 3% inflation rate, I actually think that's a good thing. And I'll probably get cancelled for this on Twitter, but I actually think it's quite a good thing where we are now, because what we're seeing is a sort of higher pressure labor market. So we're beginning to get wage growth. We're beginning to get productivity growth. We're beginning to force companies to invest rather than just rely on cheap, you know, cheap debt and cheap workers. And, you know, I think from a sort of secular story, this higher pressure economy could bring all sorts of benefits over the next 5 years if we can deliver this. And so I think this is quite an optimistic story. And, you know, obsessing over whether inflation is 2 or 3% is always seems quite bizarre when you think of where the 2% came from. I mean, it's just a number that sounds right, but there's no sort of theoretical underpinning for 2% inflation. So I gave you a short answer, but you sort of pushed me, so I gave you a longer answer as well.
I suppose, Derry, that you would be the first person on Earth to be cancelled talking about inflation. But I don't know whether a 3% inflation target could be your Me Too moment. I think we will leave the audience with that. Thank you for joining us, Derry. It's always a pleasure to host you here at Macro Sunday. And you will, of course, be back soon at the show. Thank you.
Look forward to it. Thanks.
So, Mikkel, we're back in the studio after the discussion with Dario Perkins. And for those of you who haven't watched the hit series Gomorra, I think you can kind of say that it's the Italian version of The Wire.
Yeah.
Isn't that a fair description, Mikkel? But Mikkel, setting Naples and the mafia aside, we've seen an atrocious terrorist attack in Russia. And of course, every time you see such an event, it leads to a load of speculation, even conspiracy theories surrounding this and that. Who is behind this terrorist attack? I mean, do we actually know?
I think we have a pretty good idea that this is the work of ISIS, Islamic State. They, of course, took responsibility for it after the initial speculations on social media that this was Russian, the Russian security services had instigated this as a false flag attack. I don't buy that notion at all. I think this is way too inconvenient for Putin here. I mean, he recently, after the presidential election, held a speech sort of boasting about his ability to secure law and order in Russia. This fits very, very poorly into that narrative. Furthermore, Putin has been mocking the US warnings of an ISIS strike within Russia. So for that strike to actually happen with this deadly effect is very, very inconvenient for Putin. So I don't buy that at all. It makes sense that ISIS would attack Russia, and a lot of people...
Why?
Yeah, it makes sense because they've basically spent the past decade fighting Russia all across Africa.
Yeah.
So ISIS and Russia are mortal enemies. They fought each other in Syria to equally or tough to compare, but to deadly effect as well. And basically, ISIS is growing stronger in the region they call Khorasan themselves, which is basically Central Asia, Pakistan. And this is a very strong PR move, to be a bit cynical, for that ISIS Khorasan, the Khorasan part of the ISIS movement. So, a strong PR move by ISIS. Very, very inconvenient for Russia, especially because it's getting very hard for them to frame this as a Ukrainian attack or to sort of prove that Ukraine had a hand in this.
Yeah. I know that Jackson Hinkle disagrees with that. If you follow him on X, I think that's the only social media platform where you can actually follow Jackson nowadays after he's been blocked and banned from all other social media outlets. But Miguel, in the context of this Russian attack, we know that the Russians typically lean positive on Hamas in the Hamas-Israeli conflict.
Absolutely.
And that conflict is still alive and kicking, at least by the time of the recording. So, Mikkel, a couple of weeks ago, you basically promised us that a ceasefire would be reached in the region. But here we are with that one.
Absolutely.
What's going on and why? I mean,
That was possibly a head fake ceasefire. No, I was dead wrong, as was Joe Biden, seemingly. I think what I misjudged and probably what the Americans misjudged was the determination of Benjamin Netanyahu to carry this war out and to keep his political career alive. Mm. His political career is basically dead whenever the war ends. So apparently he's determined to see this war to an end and try and get some sort of victory out of it. He's slowly, or I would say quickly perhaps, degrading the support that Israel has had in the West for centuries among governments. Most recently, the U.S. abstained from voting in the U.S. in the U.N. Security Council on the ceasefire resolution and didn't veto, as the Israelis expected. Netanyahu was furious about this, but he has to face the reality is that he is eroding on the Israeli support in the West, especially both in public public circles as well as in government circles, and that's a long-term, very big problem for Israel. And to be a bit cynical again, probably exactly what Hamas hoped for. Because both Hamas and Israel are losing support in the West. We're basically getting tired of both parties. The Hamas can live with that. The Israeli can't live with that. Because Hamas is growing exponentially more popular within the Muslim world. Mm. And the Palestinian cause has gone to the forefront of Middle Eastern politics. So the Hamas have, in a very, very cynical view, gained everything they could hope for from this war.
Yeah. And Mikkel, when we look at the ramifications for U.S. politics, I think it was through last week, I read an interview with Donald Trump on the topic of Israel-Gaza. And he essentially said that Israel had already gone too far. That's at least my reading of the interview. So is Biden also forced in that direction domestically?
Absolutely, he is. It's a very tricky situation for Biden because on the one hand, the Jewish interest groups are still very powerful in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Still has a lot of base support for Israel, but this is really hurting the U.S. Diplomatic efforts throughout the Middle East, and the public sentiment is heavily shifting against Israel. So this is a huge problem. I think Netanyahu would have hoped that the election of Trump would be of help to him. I don't think it is. I think Trump wants to end this. He wants to end all the wars, basically. So Israel is quickly losing friends all across the board. And that is, as I said, probably what Hamas would have hoped for.
Yeah. Mikkel, when I traveled London, one thing that I noted was that it was a major consensus among these portfolio managers to bet on a Trump victory come November. And I'd like your take on it first before I chip in as well. I mean, how do you, given that it's a consensus that Trump wins the election, how do you trade a Biden victory? And is a Biden victory even a feasible scenario?
Let me just start another way. How do you trade a Trump victory? We've talked about this. We've gotten a very, very clear way of trading a Trump trading in the hopes of a Trump victory. That's his Truth Social IPO. I mean, that is the most direct way you can bet on a Trump victory. Back to the question. I mean, Biden has grown or has reclaimed some of his lost territory in polls over recent weeks. I'm still not convinced that he's really ahead. If you look at it, a three-way race with both Kennedy and Trump in it, but it is a definite possibility still. I mean, he's far from out of the race. I think the Trump administration will, or a second-term Biden administration will, put even more emphasis on the green transition. I think that is what's moving them. They will try and end some of the wars, but the investments in the green sector will continue. There will be a heavy political pressure to cut rates, which is a very important factor in making these green transition projects work, basically. Yeah. So I think that is one sector that's perhaps has the biggest binary effect of this election. I mean, if Trump gets elected, it's horrible for windmills. If Biden gets elected, it's very positive. That's a very direct way of betting on this, I believe.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. The other thing is that this Biden administration has been characterized by inflation in many ways.
That's true.
And we already see how Biden accepts using the fiscal deficit to sort of fund his victory. I'm not trying to sort of debate this from a political standpoint. I'm just saying that the ramifications are clear from an inflation perspective. And I'm more inclined to say that Biden is an inflationary president than Trump is.
Absolutely.
I think that's against consensus, if I read the consensus correctly. So that's one thing. I would basically expect inflation expectations to continue up should Biden secure a victory. Another note is that Biden has already been clear on his long-term ideas on both nat gas and oil. Mm-hmm. He's currently accepting drilling or producing more because of the election date, but we'll certainly see another Biden on the other side of the election on this topic, especially given that he's got no chance of being elected once again. I mean, he couldn't give less of a basically of he couldn't care less basically about oiling nat gas after that.
No.
And therefore I also tend to think that it makes sense to buy very much out of the money calls on natural gas over the election date here, based on this logic, basically. Mm-hmm. So let's see. I mean, nat gas is a clear expression of it. You could argue that you need to short the European defense industry if Biden wins again, because the old NATO put us back. But yeah. I don't know.
No. I think whether it's Biden or Trump, the foreign policy won't be too different. The trade policy is another place that will have where the two candidates are very far apart. We don't know exactly what Trump is going to do if he wins. If Biden wins, we know kind of more or less we know the China policy he's going to pursue and the trade policy. So that is a little more given.
Yeah, but Miguel, when we look at our portfolio now,
yeah.
I mean, the head fake reflation story and narrative that we discussed initially, I got the feedback in London from one of the hedge fund clients we have that I was probably, I think, the fourth or fifth guy in a week pitching South Korea as a value trade. So I guess that's kind of telling, isn't it? I still like South Korea as a value trade. Mm-hmm. It hasn't truly accelerated despite these reflation signals from the global economy. Another country that has not accelerated given these inflation signals across the global economy is New Zealand. It's a value case that I'm very much looking at right now. I haven't pulled the trigger. And then China, obviously. We haven't really talked touched upon China so far. Tricky one right now.
I know you've been looking at the way China's hoarding copper almost right now. What's going on with that?
Well, I think our chart made the rounds, basically. It ended up being the chart of the week at Macrobond and the Daily Shot and then Bloomberg and all of that. So the Chinese copper stocks are through the roof. It's a very typical thing to see this time of year, but we just see it X2, basically. And it allows for a lot of speculation when a chart like that arrives from China. Yeah. Because, I mean, typically you would argue that building stock or building inventory is a sign that you're not using it. Yeah, so, that's actually a negative, right? But when it comes to China, the reading is the exact opposite from market participants. I've gotten a lot of questions on, could this be China contemplating something geopolitically? Do they want to secure their copper stocks ahead of doing something? And that doing something is very unclear. Could it be China loading up storages ahead of a major overhaul of the electric grid because of this major move towards EVs in China? Wouldn't rule that out either, but I don't think we have any clear evidence of it. So my point here is that speculation is also through the roof on copper because of this Chinese hoarding. And I'm not convinced that they're hoarding for the right reasons. So we've basically taken a very, very decent profit in copper, consequently, because I don't think I have an edge here.
No. This could be, from a political standpoint, a knee-jerk reaction. We know that China is still very much centrally controlled. If the central government has pushed out a signal that we are going to be consuming more copper over the next 4 years, it would be logical for government-run companies or for local regions to basically hoard copper. And if they do it all at the same time, this is exactly what you were going to get. So this could be sort of an overreaction to some political signaling out of the central committee. Yeah.
But wouldn't you agree with me, Mikkel, that should this have happened in Europe, we would have said, why build stocks? Because we don't need it, right?
Exactly.
Because there's more transparency around the need for it.
Yeah.
And that's the question here. Do they have a plan that we don't know of yet?
Yeah. Or is this simply a case of Communist Party officials all sort of panicking over the same bubble? So is this a politically created bubble? I don't know. It's very tough to say. We basically don't know what's going on out there.
Yeah. And that's why I took profit. I mean, I dislike trading something I don't know.
Yeah.
And I guess that's it.
We don't really know what's going on.
No.
That's the bottom line out there. Yeah. Yeah. Something you didn't know a lot about. We talked about it a little bit earlier, that the European Central Bank may be kicking off the cutting season a little bit earlier. Is the consensus June? You talked about a little bit earlier.
Yeah, without a doubt. It's almost like everyone's concluded that all central banks on Earth will start cutting in June, or at least all central banks within the G10 sphere. Mm-hmm. I when I see such uniformity in expectations, the only thing I know is that everyone will be surprised. and the question is here, how do you bet on the surprises? We've been leaning heavily into euro duration over the past few weeks. We see a few decent signs out of the inflation numbers that we've received so far from the Eurozone. We see a possible discussion already at the April meeting of a rate cut. And we see much more benign money trends, if you look at it from the perspective of the central bank, in the Eurozone. We don't have aggressive M2 growth relative to trend. We have that in the US now, if you ask me. So money trends are diverging in the US versus the Eurozone, and that's all I need to trade the relative rate spread here. I'm very convinced that the European Central Bank will cut by more than priced, and I doubt it highly for the Fed.
Very good. I mean, that's all you can hope for, a very actionable advice based on our analysis. To get much more of that, tune into stenresearch.com, look at our options for subscriptions there, or contact us if you're interested in institutional packages. We do a lot of those as well.
We have a whole team on Bloomberg, I think. Absolutely. 5-6 members after all now. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Always someone to reach, even through Easter. Be somewhat reachable, even though in here in Scandinavia, of course, we have longer Easter holidays than the rest of the world, as always.
Yeah. And Mikkel, since we employ quite a few people as of now, we have to lament that. Yeah. And I mean, we're always off in Scandinavia. That's
absolutely.
Kind of it.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, Andreas, any more points we need to cover, or would that be it?
No.
Great. Then let's round off with our usual disclaimer from Gennaro Gattuso.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it may be good, sometimes it may be shit.
Thanks a lot for listening. We'll see you next week.